The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning, everyone. And today I'd like to give a talk on ethics, and in particular on the topic of the first precept, which is not killing. Perhaps it's a continuation of the earth care topic. Make some connection between it. And the precept of not killing is a precept of compassion. It's a precept that's a kind of cardinal or fundamental precept in Buddhism, because it's not just a precept of not to kill, but it's also a precept of not intentionally to cause harm. And so to look at the word in ethic in Buddhism for ethics or virtue is sila, spelled S-I-L-A. And it's nice to think of it as one leg of a tripod. And you know, if you have a tripod and you only have one leg, it falls over. And if you have two legs, it falls over. But if you have three legs, then it can stand upright. So the three legs of the tripod are, in the Buddhist language, is sila, samadhi, and panya. And that's usually translated into English as virtue, meditation or personal cultivation and development, and then wisdom or discernment or investigation, seeing deeply into our lives. And these three work together. The virtue has a lot to do with how we are. Not how we are, but how we train ourselves and how we behave in our life. Samadhi has a lot to do with how we are, the quality of our being. And the wisdom factor has a lot to do with how we see things and how we investigate, how we look more deeply. And so if you look and see without it changing your behavior, it's probably not so useful. If you change your behavior but don't consider the quality of your inner life, it could be shallow, it could be, it doesn't really get the important information that can guide us in our lives. But these three together, that we have a way of behaving and care and our choices of what we do, but to have that be guided by the quality of our being, how we are. And so part of Buddhist practice is to cultivate ourselves, to train ourselves, so we can change the quality of our heart, the quality of our being. We behave very differently in life if we are obsessed with fear or anger or hate, than if we are filled with compassion and kindness and goodwill. So these are different qualities. So how do you want to? Well, how do you want to be? You don't have to just go along with whatever way you wake up one morning, but we can cultivate and develop qualities of heart, qualities of mind that are useful, productive, that are meaningful, and become important references for how we want to live our lives, the choices we make. The samadhi, the second one, having to do with the cultivation of how we are, involves issues like of integration, becoming wholly integrated. So all of who we are is somehow integrated rather than fragmented, so that our hearts, our minds, and our bodies somehow connected and inform each other. So we don't have walled-off areas of our life that are in conflict with parts of ourselves, because the walled-off areas, the conflicted areas within ourselves, are often the juncture or the cracks where the unethical behavior can occur. And so part of the function of meditation practice, of samadhi practices, the cultivation practice in Buddhism, is to help make us whole, make us integrated, to be aware of all of ourselves, and then hold it together in some kind of holistic way. A samadhi practice also, some people think of it just concentration, but it also involves a heightened sensitivity to develop our capacity for empathy, sensitivity, for mindfulness, for awareness. Because our capacity to be sensitive to the world around us, to see clearly, understand clearly, is very much dependent on how settled we are, how calm we are. if we are preoccupied and anxious and spinning out of control in the mind, there's probably not a lot of sensitivity to yourself in a deeper way, or sensitivity to others and how they are. So samadhi is a way of training ourselves to have a heightened sensitivity. And then from that sensitivity, heightened sensitivity, comes as a basis for ethical decision-making. And this wisdom part, the panya, prajna, has a lot to do with how we see, but also how we investigate, how we understand, the perspectives that we use. And one of the primary ethical perspectives in Buddhism, or the primary one, is to avoid causing harm to oneself or to others. That's the standard for ethical decisions. So that helps us from taking, for example, the precepts in what could be called moralistic terms, black and white terms, as if they're criteria in and of themselves for our behavior. The precepts are criteria for our behavior, but they are understood through the framework of not causing harm. So that, you know, plays out, I think, most dramatically for some people in the modern world around sexuality. Buddhism, for lay people, the precept around sexuality is avoid inappropriate sexual behavior or sexual misconduct. And how do you know what that is? And there are people who have particular ideas of what sexual behavior is deviant and what is acceptable, as if it's defined by the behavior. In Buddhism, how we understand the ethics of sexuality has to do with, is it causing harm? Not by the behavior, not by whether it's you're heterosexual or homosexual or whatever it might be. Is it causing harm? And then you get a different evaluation, different determination of sexual ethics than if you have somehow a authoritarian that comes down from someone else that certain behaviors are acceptable and certain are not. So the same thing then with all the other precepts. The fundamental framework for them is, do they cause harm, to avoid causing harm. So that requires us being able to see harm, to recognize harm and the possibility of harm, and to recognize how to avoid causing that harm. So the samadhi practice, by cultivating a heightened mindfulness, sensitivity, integration, helps us to understand how to tune in to what's harmful, what isn't harmful, in a way that it's very hard to do if it's just kind of an analytical exercise to figure out what's, you know, what is causing harm. So the most basic way that these ethics are taught in terms of behavior in Buddhism for lay people is the five precepts. And these five precepts are precepts in the sense that they're principles of training, that we train ourselves around these guidelines in order to develop our virtue, in order to develop our samadhi and develop our wisdom. They're not meant to be black and white, you know, all or nothing, you know, rules. In fact, to have a strong rule-based approach to spiritual life probably limits the capacity to develop virtue, integration and samadhi and wisdom. Wisdom, it requires kind of a deeper engagement and exploration and investigation into these realms for us to get the most benefit from them. There's a beautiful passage about the first precept, not taking life. Abandoning the taking of life, one abstains from taking life. This gives freedom from danger, freedom from hostility, and freedom from troubles to limitless numbers of beings. In doing this, one gains a share in limitless freedom from danger, freedom from animosity, and freedom from trouble. It's understood in the early tradition that living by the five precepts can partly done as a gift to others. We make ourselves safe to others people don't have to be afraid of us. We create a community, a society that feels comfortable to be in. One of the remarkable things about going on a meditation retreat, a Vipassana retreat, is the degree of safety in these groups when we're together. It's a place where some people feel more safe in a retreat than almost anywhere else in their life, because there's a shared commitment to a higher ethical standard. You could leave your wallet right in the middle of a retreat center, and chances are pretty high, higher than most other places in the world, that it'll either be there or it'll be turned into the office, and you can pick it up later. You don't have to. In fact, most retreat centers, people don't lock their bedroom doors. They live in buildings that are not locked. It's kind of, far-fetched that this, is kind of unusual. How many of you live go to sleep at night with your doors unlocked? Most people, I think, lock them and feel safer that way. So they're safe place. So to feel the safety is very meaningful for the heart and meaningful for this cultivation of practice. And here in this quote, it says, in giving this freedom from fear and animosity to others, you gain a piece of that. Isn't that great? It's a reciprocal, mutual relationship. We live ethically, and we support others in that, and in return, we're supported by that. Sometimes these five precepts, so they are not killing, not taking what's not given, not engaging in sexual misconduct, not lying, and not intoxicating oneself with alcohol or drugs. These in the Buddhist tradition are considered very important. They're kind of partly because they're five simple things that you can remember relatively easily. In the ancient world, the Buddha didn't actually teach much about the five precepts. It didn't. My way of reading the early text is it wasn't really a big emphasis. But what became a big emphasis was something closely connected to these five, and these are called the 10 skillful actions. And the 10 skillful actions are interesting because they are more than just guidelines for a particular way of behaving. So the first four are the same: not to kill, not to steal, not to engage in sexual misconduct, and not to lie. The next four, next three, have to do with other aspects of speech: not to gossip, not to have harsh speech, and not to engage in trivial, pointless speech. And then the last three, this is what kind of makes them particularly more applicable or have deeper meaning in our lives than the five precepts: to avoid greed, to avoid hate, and to avoid what's called wrong view. So now we're into the world of the heart or the mind, what motivates us to act. Some teachers who teach the five precepts emphasize that it's best to take them black and white. Don't kill. Don't steal. Don't engage in sexual misconduct. Don't lie. And somehow, some people complain and say, well, there's always exceptions and it's too kind of moralistic. And I'd rather than say, don't kill, I'd like to say, live compassionately for all beings, which is a nice sentiment, but it's not so obvious what living compassionately means. It's kind of clear what killing means. So if you're going to kill the ants in your house, and the precept says don't kill, that would probably force you to think a little bit. If the precept is to be compassionate, what does it mean to be compassionate to those ants? It's a little bit, maybe it's easier to kind of, something different. And so perhaps the five precepts have their power by taking them in narrow sense as being literal, and not in a kind of figurative sense, which some people do. And not killing, not taking what's not giving means don't dominate the conversation by just talking all the time. Then you're taking the person's time, which hasn't been given. That's nice. It's wise. But once we start kind of getting into the other aspects of the five precepts, the subtleties, the applications that way, some people feel they lose their power. and they lose their power when they're done strictly. So in Thailand, for example, people there tend to understand the precepts very clearly. You just don't kill any living being. And for lay people, they might have exceptions for themselves in their lives, except for the days they go to the temple, the Buddhist temple. Then they're impeccable about following it. No exceptions that day. So they kind of had a sense. So they see it as a training or something. So the 10 skillful actions, however, are the ones that go deeper in. They're not just black and white or this clear kind of cut thing. Because for the first one, not to kill, it's worded this way. abstaining from killing living beings with weapons laid aside, gentle and kindly, one abides compassionate to all living beings. So here the standard is a little bit different. Here the standard is, yes, avoid killing, but also be compassionate. Cultivate compassion. Abide with compassion to the world. And the idea of having compassion and being informed by your compassion in your ethical decision-making is a very useful thing to do. How do you live your life if you're closely in touch with compassion? If you ask yourself, what's the compassionate thing to do now? As opposed to, you know, what's the right thing to do? Now this becomes important also in Buddhist ethical consideration. What we see in the early Buddhist tradition that I feel most connected to is ethics keeps being referring back to what you would do in your particular situations. That's the investigation, that's the consideration. So in the immediacy of your life, how would you live your life? What are choices you would make? As opposed to generalizing. And generalizing can lead to what can be like moralizing to in a kind of rigid way, which is kind of oppressive for other people. There's a different, you know, the word moralistic sometimes has negative connotations when it's used sometimes. If someone who generalizes on issues of right and wrong and often has a sense of superiority that they know better than others and others should live the same way. Different ways of using that word. But the idea that others should be this way as well, we should generalize into our society wide, is a different ethical kind of consideration than what you would do. What would you do in a particular situation? What would you do if you were in the slaughterhouse looking in the eyes of the cow that you're going to eat? How would you, you know, what decisions would you make then? As opposed to, we should not have slaughterhouses. Maybe we shouldn't, maybe we should, who knows? But that's, that, you know, instead of generalizing, the pointing of ethics in Buddhism is in the experiences of life that you encounter, how do you behave? What do you do? And I think that that kind of pointing to yourself saves us a little bit from immediately looking for exceptions. But what about in those circumstances? You know, it's easy to then want to give exceptions in those circumstances, but it's probably pretty rare that most of you are going to be in those circumstances. One of the very common exceptions that are commonly used around not lying is, what if the Nazis come and you harboring a Jew in your house? It's unlikely that's going to happen anymore. I mean, something similar might happen. Again, it happens other places in the world, but that particular example is a generalization. What do you do then? It's an interesting exercise, but it takes too easily takes the focus away of what we would do in a situation. And the point in Buddhism is to come back here to what's close at hand, to what you can, what you're encountering, and how would you live in the world that you encounter. What are the decisions you would make? Because if you really see someone in the eye, then how do you relate to them? How does it touch your heart to see someone in the eye? as opposed to, you know, not. I've read stories of people, hunters, who were out hunting, and they saw a deer, and they put the deer in the scope of their rifle to shoot, and somehow they looked right into the eyes of the deer. And when they saw into the eyes of the deer, they saw a life there that they couldn't kill. I've heard of people sometimes when humans get executed, hoods are put over their heads so that you don't see the humanity, you don't see the eyes of the people. I've known people who've had enemies and stood face to face with enemies, and only when they looked each other deep in the eye did somehow something opened up in the person that they couldn't see them as an enemy anymore. So what happened, you know, the emphasis on the direct human contact and experience, how is it in our life? How do we see things? How do we do things? I think is more the focus on Buddhist ethics rather than moralizing in abstract ways. Does that make some sense? So I'll probably moralize in abstract ways anyway today, but it's so hard not to. You know, it's not so black and white, these things, right? Or the line is not so sharp. That's what I mean. So one of the key ways that we use in Buddhism to investigate or be present for the immediacy of our experience ethically is to ask ourselves, what is the intention we have? What's motivating us in what we want to do? So if we do want to kill a mosquito, what's motivating it? If we do want to kill another person, what's motivating it? Is it in fact, are we motivated by hate? Are we motivated by greed? Are we motivated by fear? What is going on for us? And I would suspect that the people here, some of you, you know, if someone invaded your house, you know, came into your house, broke into your house, probably fear would be the operating emotion. And if you wanted to kill that person in self-defense, probably you would be motivated by fear. But what happened if you knew how not to be motivated by fear? If fear didn't have the upper hand, would it give you an ability to look and see in other ways? I've known people who have in fact been held up by guns and knives, who somehow, maybe because of the intensity of the situation, did not get afraid. I'd like to believe these are people who practice meditation for a long time, so I'd like to believe their meditation kind of kicked in. And they engage the person in a compassionate way, in a clear way, and it disarmed the whole situation. I have one friend who didn't do that, and he's the one who ended up in jail. You know, he got somehow got pulled into his anger, and kind of basically went after the person, and so he was the one who ended up in jail. So the ability to stay calm sometimes leads to wiser decisions than to act impulsively out of fear or anger. So we look at ourselves. So if we have the ability to reflect, and decisions don't have to be made right away, what's motivating us? Greed, hate, or fear? And I suspect that a lot of motivation around some of the decisions we have to kill involve one of those three. We also investigate, are there alternatives? The idea of alternatives and taking time to investigate and consider it, I think, is an extremely important one. Because I run into people often enough in these kinds of discussions who are, for some reason, very quick to want to justify the use of force, the use of violence. I don't know why it's such a strong one, such a strong desire to justify it so quickly. It's very similar to the strong justification for anger. But anger has a purpose. Violence is maybe a quick solution. And sometimes you get what you want quickly. But the consequences in the long term might not be so useful, so meaningful. The This morning in the New York Times, there was a article about a man who was, a soldier in the Irish Republican Army, and his job was to be an assassin. And he spent many years in British jail, and now trying to, make amends for what he did. But the article discusses, he talks about, I think he wrote a book about his experience, and he killed many people apparently. Only one person he walked into a bar and shot someone who later he found out he was misinformed about what this person had done. He hadn't done what they thought he had done and why they thought he was justified to kill him. And so he shot this guy in the back and killed him. And then he left, and there was a woman who was a getaway driver, drove him off, and they went off. And when they were going to part ways, the woman said, "I feel sorry for your mother. I feel sorry for your mother." Quite something, huh? What about the mothers? What about the network of consequences that go out, or that person's mother or children? I am kind of blown away by how long violence survives in the extended network, the consequences, the extended network of people who have been affected by it. Some of you I've told already, I think my father-in-law died this summer in August, and he was a Holocaust survivor. And the violence and that he experienced during 70 years ago was still very fresh for him, and it was so fresh for him that my spending my last week of his life with him, what happened to him in World War II had a deep impact on me. 70 years ago something happened, and it's still this impact, and it had a deep impact on my 15-year-old son, who interviewed him about his experience in the war. And I suspect that experience will be with my son, the memory of them. If my son filmed him, he just likes to make documentaries, so I'm sure it's going to stay with him for, probably it could be, for his lifetime. And if he lives to be the same age as his grandfather, it'll mean that 140 years after World War II, there are still people who feel a personal connection to the violence that happened there. Isn't that amazing? And understands a little bit about why the violence of civil war has still such a big impact on the United States, or the violence of slavery has such a big impact that continues down to this, down to today in our society. So what are the extensive network of consequences that violence has? Even though it seems like you get what you want in the moment, how does it affect people? So part of the investigation is not just what's the situation here and now and the choices we're involved in, but what are the consequences into the future or to around us in other ways. I think I've told this before too many times, but I'll make the point. Sometimes when my kids were really young, they were a challenge, like all kids are. And I sometimes found the only thing that would work in my limited ability to be a parent was to use my strong voice. That's what I called it. Sometimes I'd warn them, "I'm going to use my strong voice." And a strong way of saying no, really loudly. "You can't do that." And I thought, well, that worked. That was good, it worked. Until the day where I heard my older son use that same voice for a younger brother. And then I thought, oh my God, what have I created? What have I done? Because the kids learn from us, right? How we behave. And so in the moment of using strong voice, the consequences were good, I thought. But little did I anticipate how the influence was going to have down through time. So how do we take this into account, these kinds of things? One of the ways we can take it into account is what is the influence it has on us? when we act in certain ways, how does it affect, how does it train our hearts? How does it, the samadhi part, how does it cultivate our hearts in a way that's useful? So so I try hard not to kill insects. And I've been known to go out and catch mosquitoes with my hand, like cup my hand around them, and then carry them out of the house. Ask someone to open the door because I can't, and let them go. And, you know, is that silly? It's consequential. These mosquitoes shouldn't count. You know, it's just a waste of time. There's more important things to do than chase them around the house for them. Or I've done the same thing with flies, you know, catch them with butterfly nets and take them outside. But one of the things that, one of the consequences for me having done that is that there's a visceral memory in my heart of a nice feeling that came from that kind of care. And that nice memory is with me. Some of these cupping of mosquitoes when I was in mosquito land, I go back 25 years. And I don't really remember all the circumstances of it, but I remember what it felt like to do that. It kind of was a conditioning for me. And I know what it feels like to go like that to the mosquito. And I tell you, it conditions me in a different way. So part of the consequence is also in ourselves, to investigate in it, and then to consider what are the alternatives. Are there alternatives? To take the time, maybe before you find yourself in a situation where violence is the, seems like the right answer, to consider what are the alternatives that are possible. So some people in our country are quick to buy guns and feel very justified to defend themselves with guns, sometimes to the degree that it will involve killing someone else. But have they taken the time to cultivate and develop alternative strategies? Even if they do have a gun in the house, have they trained themselves in nonviolent ways of defending themselves? Have they trained themselves in some of the skills and techniques? Have they put on alarms in their house? Have they done all the things they can do to try to prevent needing to use the gun? Some people don't want to do that because they feel it's an imposition to do so much work. It's just easier just to have a gun and they feel justified in it. But is that really the best thing for yourself and for the world around you? I suspect that the people who have been justified in killing and have killed, I suspect most of them are deeply affected by this. And I don't know if in retrospect they look back and say, I wish I hadn't done that. Probably they wish they hadn't done that. Probably, you know, it's a heavy thing to carry on the heart to do this. So to consider alternatives to killing, what are they? So I spent a lot of time trying to figure out alternatives to killing those ants that come into my kitchen. And I tried all kinds of things. And the two things that I finally figured out that works for us and doesn't involve killing them, they certainly keep the kitchen clean, but cinnamon. And the consequence is that now we have, occasionally once or twice a year, we'll have these little piles of cinnamon where they get come in, the ants come in. But the ants don't cross the cinnamon. Isn't that nice? So it took a while to get to that. But I feel so much better having cinnamon around my house than having poison that you put out, you know, that the ants eat the poison and they take it back to their ant colonies and then everyone dies in the colonies. I don't like that idea. But cinnamon, they don't cross. So are there alternatives? So this idea of investigating and looking and questioning ourselves, what motivates us, what are the consequences, what are the alternatives, are all part of the ethical training in Buddhism. And that training benefits a lot from the integration work of... That's very nice. When we had cell phones go off in the beginning, in the early years, I used to think it was kind of like an imposition. And now I think of them as wonderful mindfulness spells. You get to stop and look and pause. And in the beginning, when I started to stop and pause and look, rather, I could feel that some, you know, this certain kind of negative feelings and ideas would come up. But I shouldn't be that way. How could they? But I don't need to think that way. I mean, why does a hiss? You know, what are we doing here in this life of ours? Are we here to kind of be? Is it we better off by judging and? Shouldn't be this way. Just because of a little cell phone? Or are we better off using it as a mindfulness spell? Pause, look around. One of the cardinal kind of, or not cardinal, but one of the, I think, first approaches to almost anything for people who are dedicated to mindfulness is to investigate. What is this? What's going on now? So for this first precept, not to kill, investigation, look more deeply. Cell phones go off. Stop, investigate. What's going on? Whatever's going on, look. So I was going to give a short talk today. I apologize. Is this okay? Is this boring for me to go on and on? So then the question, but you know, the issue of not killing is, there's a tendency in Buddhism sometimes to be very, in traditional Buddhism, to be very clear, don't kill at all. But it goes, there's a conflict that some people see between the more fundamental precept of not causing harm or minimizing harm and not killing. So what causes the least amount of harm in the world? Not spraying for malaria mosquitoes or spraying for malaria mosquitoes. So when we, if there's malaria in the area and you spray for them, or west here in California, West Nile, or West Nile virus, what causes the least amount of harm? If the precept is don't kill, then those mosquitoes can make human beings sick, or sometimes lethally. I had a friend who died from malaria. So what do we do? And how do we make this decision? Where do we make the decision? Most of us here, I suspect, would not think twice about using antibiotics to kill those bacteria if you're sick. You know, that's the least amount of harm is about, you know, for you, is have the bacteria die, not you. What about if you have mosquitoes that have malaria? Do you spray? We have a well in our property. And so one of the decisions is, do we put in poison in the well so that the mosquitoes can't breed, because mosquitoes breed in our well, they go into our neighbor's property and they spread out all over Emerald Hills. And so, you know, do we have a responsibility not to be a vector for West Nile virus if it comes to this area? And, you know, what should we do there? You could say that I mostly can cop out of the decision because the San Mateo County comes around every few months and drops pellets into our well. So, you know, someone else does it. But what do we do? And then what about, you know, there's mice and rats, I guess, that have bubonic plague in California. So what do you do then if, you know, now we're getting to mammals, you know, our close relatives. So they have bubonic plague. Do we kill them? Do we not kill them? What causes the least amount of harm? From the point of view of the precept not to kill, you don't kill the rats. But from the point of view of maybe saving your life or your kid's life, maybe you don't want to have those near your house. Gophers. You know, Do you kill them, or do you let your garden die? What's your choice do you make? Some people, when you get these kinds of questions, some people choose to live lifestyles that they're not involved in that kind of life whatsoever. And sometimes I've seen monastics very clearly, they didn't become monastics because they wanted to avoid those things, but they were content or happy that in being monastics, they didn't have to be involved in any of those kinds of decisions. So is that a copping out? Is it letting other people make the decisions? Not being part of that part of the world? But all of us here are lay people, so how do we participate in these kinds of decisions? You know, so there's immediate ones in our lives, and then there's a whole slew of them that we participate by virtue of being in our society and members and citizens of the society. We participate indirectly. How responsible are? How are we involved in these kind of decisions more widely? How can we be involved in these that our behavior and votes and money affect these things? How do we decide in ways that is not moralistic, but you know we feel the impact in our choices? So I want to list a whole bunch of interesting, important topics that fall under the investigation for the not killing precept. War, military, abortion, suicide, euthanasia, meat eating, hunting, firearms, pest management, culling of wildlife, investments, capital punishment, laboratory research on animals, and then use of natural resources. There's a lot of death happens around the use of natural resources. So how do we from our individual point of view, how we live in our society, how do we participate? How do we engage and how do we consider the larger impacts of our lives? And I think our motivation, our intention, are the consequences of our choices, and then what are the alternatives? Really investigate more deeply what's going on. For these larger issues in our lives, one of the very easy motivations is the motivation of avoidance. It's not up to me. This is like other people make these choices, and so a kind of certain delusion of indifference that go on. But how do we participate in this? How do we get involved? And I'll end this way. With all all these precepts, but with the precept of not killing, I think that it's a very meaningful and important area of personal exploration. And as we explore this precept and how we live with it, how does it make us better people? How does it help cultivate and develop the best in our hearts? A settled and peaceful and sensitive, empathic heart. How does it do that? As opposed to the moralistic idea, I'm good or bad if I do yes, you know, one way or the other. How do we cultivate the best in our hearts? Because I have a lot of confidence in the best in human hearts, the goodness in human hearts. And if we can cultivate that, then that will spread out in the choices we make and how we live in our communal life as well. So that how we live becomes a gift to the world around us, which is one of the things the Buddha said, that follow the precepts and you become a gift. Okay, thank you. And those of you who are interested, in about 10, 15 minutes, we'll meet back in here for a kind of an open discussion about, not this topic exactly, but on earth care, environmentalism, living green mostly. The practical, immediate, inspiring things that we can do to follow up last week's earth care discussion. Thank you.